Can you say something smart for us?
No.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 329 for the week of November 16th, 2020. I am Tokyo Drifter David T. Cole, and I'm here with Parallel Player Sarah D. Bunting.
Mine.
Tournament Object Tara Ariano.
Oh, I'm not going anywhere.
And Emerging Sense of Self Omar Gallaga.
Me? Me.
Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joining us is our dear friend Omar Gallaga. Hello, Omar.
Omar.
Hey, everybody.
Yay! Omar's back to discuss the new docuseries on Apple TV Plus called Becoming You. This covers the first 2,000 days on Earth of a collection of 100 children from around the world. It is narrated, I will say, beautifully by our friend Olivia Colman, not our friend. We just love her. I believe I speak for us all when I say that. I think that's fair. And so it covers in 6 episodes developmental processes like forming identity, moving, talking, thinking, all the big ones that you get through in your first 5 or so years of life. So as I said, I think all 6 episodes dropped on Apple TV Plus on Friday. We may talk about events from any of them, although I don't think you can really say we will spoil a show like this. There are babies. Doesn't
they
have a plot.
5. Spoiler.
Right. So before we get into it, though, let's just quickly go around the circle and check in with everyone's quick takes on whether people should watch this. Omar, go first. Should people watch Becoming You?
I can't imagine that people who are not parents or interested in parenting would have that much interest in it. So I would say it's not a must watch. It's interesting. It's got some interesting moments. It's beautifully filmed. But I would say it doesn't rise to the level of a must watch.
Okay. Sarah, you're a fan of documentaries. What is your take as a non-parent?
I'm with Omar. It is beautifully shot. It is beautifully narrated. There are some very cute moments and very cute outfits on the children that I need to be available in adult size, but unless you're like sourcing pink bear sweatshirts, which you're not because you're a normal person, not like me. It's lovely, but it's not essential, I wouldn't say.
Much like children, it vacillates between quite interesting and incredibly boring. It's the exact kind of show that you think Apple would make is this show.
Yeah, that's a great take. I agree. It's cute in parts, and then there's other parts where it's like, oh, we're at the point where a bunch of kids are screaming. This is why I don't have children. So yeah, it's interesting in parts, but it's 6 episodes seems like a lot. I mean, if you're interested in this, I would just watch the documentary Babies, which I think is still on Netflix, and that'll get you your baby fix. Probably a lot faster with only 5 babies and has more of a narrative thrust.
All right, so we're out of the Chen zone, but there is, I thought, interesting things about this show. Mm-hmm. The first episode is called Who Am I? And it's all about just discovering yourself, you know, as your brain gets bigger. And the second one was
moving.
Yeah, like getting around with your feet and whatnot. So the second one about moving, you're like, okay, kids get up, they fall down, they grab on things to get up. It was just like a very mechanical episode that I thought, I've done that. I could do that better than stupid baby. So I wasn't really, like, there was nothing new for me to grab on there. But the first episode about Who Am I thought was very interesting. Like, it opens up with this kid in Tokyo. And there's this cultural milestone in Japan I've never heard about
before. No, me neither.
And it's fascinating. It's called the first Aaron.
Yeah.
And kids as young as 3 are sent out by themselves to do some small errand in their neighborhood by themselves. And in this case, there is a kid who is sent out to get sushi from the local sushi restaurant. And he has to cross like streets and a train track and
go through an underpass,
pay the guy and all this sort of stuff. And like that alone was like, wow, I kind of want a documentary just about the first errand thing, because that is fascinating. And I think it's actually really good idea, but also probably terrifying to a lot of parents. But I kind of get it, why it's a thing.
Yeah.
So it goes from very hot to very cold for me as far as like what I got out of it and how interesting I thought it was.
Yeah.
What it was at its most interesting, it was really interesting. It was really like captivating and it held my attention. Mm-hmm. And when it didn't, I was on my phone so much during the second episode. It's one of those shows.
Yeah. Omar, you chose the show from the list of this week's premieres. When we were emailing about it last week, you were very excited to, and I quote, "See them babies." Was the show
what not you like that, Kara?
No, no, just no, to see them like babies in a normal way.
Drac, them.
Was the show what you expected and hoped for from a show about babies when you chose it?
It was a little too much what I expected. I mean, like has been said, I mean, it's very much exactly what you would expect from Apple TV, kind of middle of the road, mm-hmm. very standard format docu-series. But the stuff where it does break out and get interesting is a lot of it is more less about the development of the kids than the culture that they're in. I mean,
right.
They come back to Japan like 3 or 4 times, and there's an episode that I think the 4th or 5th episode where it's a ritual with sumo wrestlers yelling in the baby's face.
One.
Oh, that was great. That was
cry,
awesome.
Cry, Rin. Do your best.
Yeah. Cry,
you know, making, so cute.
Making the kid cry, screaming in their face. And that's another rite of passage. And I mean, you know, they seem particularly fascinated with Japanese rites of passage, which is great. But when you get to, you know, kids, you know, American kids, it feels like there's like a low key critique of helicopter American parenting. Like all of these kids around the world are running errands across train tracks and surfing and catching fish for their parents and riding yaks. And we're over here like, you know, crying because, you know, it's an improv class or something. I don't know. So it definitely felt like as an American parent, I was like, hey, like, yeah, my kids are helpless. So,
yeah,
it felt like so that's where it gets interesting. The development stuff, it only kind of breaks out of that shell once or twice where there's something genuinely surprising or genuinely interesting. Like as a parent, I never really caught the moment where my kids became self-aware, became aware that they were a separate being from the people around them. That never occurred to me that that's even a thing.
Right.
And to have that explained and illustrated was really, really fascinating. I mean, I'd never thought that about my kids that way, of having looked in a mirror and thought they were the same person as the parent or whatever. That no one ever told me that.
If you didn't see it, are you sure it happened? Do your kids refer to each other as Omar?
I was there for the first step. I missed the self-identity part. So stuff like that as a parent, I find fascinating, but a lot of it is stuff that like you're just kind of reliving these moments that you had as a parent of, you know, the first step. And the show tries to attach significance and illustrate like this is the moment that takes them to this other place, but then you never see that other place because it's a limited window of when it was filmed. It's not
right.
Like 7 Up where you see them, you know, 7 years later where that took them. You know, it's very surfacey, a very shallow look at child development. And you just have to take their word for it that everything they're telling you, you know, experts say, or the, you know, scientists tell us, you know, and you'd have to just take their word for it that that's the current thinking in child development.
Right.
And to just illustrate Omar's point about the culture often being more interesting in the second episode, which was generally kind of boring. The most interesting part was this Mongolian child who had to learn how to hop on a reindeer.
I think it was a yak.
Yak? No, it wasn't a yak.
No,
too small.
I think it was a reindeer.
Yeah, I think it was a reindeer.
Was it? Okay.
And that was interesting. And like, and then he's like riding the reindeer across their like their nomadic, you know, pasture or whatever they're doing.
Or the girl teaching herself to swim in stilt village
in Borneo. Yeah,
Borneo. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was very interesting. So yeah, I think that's an astute observation that it is more interesting when it is showing development, but also showing cultures outside of your own experience.
Yeah. We'll get back to the childless monsters in a second, the rest of us. But Omar is the only parent on panel. Now your daughters are all old and shit. Did this make you nostalgic for their first 2000 days or relieved that those days are behind you?
Well, until I kind of hit that boredom wall where I was looking at my phone and kind of like, okay, this is 6 episodes. This is a lot. That first episode or two, yeah, I was getting really teary-eyed. I was remembering those moments of, you know, like first day of school and first day of walking. Like those things really hit you. And you're so busy as a parent those first 2 or 3 years just putting out fires and trying to get sleep and just trying to keep your house in order that you miss a lot of the day-to-day because you're just not – your brain is not – functioning at that speed where you can appreciate any of it. So to kind of go back in this beautifully filmed, you know, way and relive some of that was very emotional. But at the same time, like, I wanted more of that, more of these kids' stories. And I feel like it's got some significant blind spots in terms of, well, what happens when these kids aren't from, you know, these well-to-do families, you right. know, that are intact, that are, you
yeah.
know, all the Western families in this docuseries are all living in gorgeous, you know, apartments and homes.
Oh my God, the Brooklyn ones. I was like, couple notes.
It's like, oh, well, we live next to a mountain. It's like, it's a gorgeous house next to a mountain.
I also am not sure, like, I only watched the two episodes, that first one and the episode four feeling. And there were a couple of witty moments that I made note of. One was the cut from screaming toddlers to the screaming of a hawk in Nepal, which I thought was really funny. I was like, did a parent edit this? And the other one was, in part of feeling is how older siblings try to manage their feelings of jealousy with the younger sibling.
Ah.
And as the baby is like baby walking down the hall towards the 4-year-old's carefully set up train set and his like playtime with dad, the music is like dun 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 dun, like total Jaws ripoff that I just thought was so funny because as an older sibling, been there.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they got into any of this in other episodes, but kind of going back to what Omar was saying, like, what about kids who are not neurotypical? What about kids mm-hmm. with physical challenges?
Right. The second episode, Moving, does cover a pair of twins who are learning to walk, and one of them is sighted and the other is blind. And they talk about
gotcha.
How mm-hmm. she has a biological imperative to learn to walk, even though she's never seen anyone do it. And that I thought that
right.
was interesting. So, you know,
oh, that's kind of interesting.
To expand their lens, as it were, to include... you know, a wider range of children and abilities and stuff.
I watched all six, and yeah, there is an episode where there's a deaf family that speaks in sign language, but both in the case of the blind child and the deaf child, it's like they're there to illustrate a larger point about speech or a larger
right.
point about
right.
You know, developing movement, or, you know, I mean, so it's like, it's not that their story is interesting, it's that
this is the
illustrate the point of how neurotypical kids would develop. So, I mean, it is diverse in the sense of, like, there's kids from all these different cultures, but I don't feel like there's a lot of economic diversity. And, mm-hmm. And I also feel like, you know, it leaves out a lot of things that can affect development, like abuse, economics, like, you know, and like what about kids that don't get this kind of attention or don't develop in this way? Where do they go? So it felt like there was a couple of big blind spots that were like, yeah, let's not get into all that area. That's too dark.
Yeah, fair. Tenzing in Nepal, low key, a pretty good photographer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When they showed his work, I was like, damn, he's really good.
It was really good. It's great to pick it up when you're a child, because a child, you have no qualms about just getting in somebody's face,
yep.
taking a picture, and they allow it. Whereas the older you get, the more likelihood you're going to get punched or told off for doing the same thing. So good on him for getting in early.
Yeah. It was fine. I definitely agree with Omar that, you know, when the American kids are the least interesting ones in their story, like, I wish I thought, go ahead.
The exception being the introduction through the San Antonio family about
the flying
baseball,
chanclas,
which I had to explain, but, or somebody explained it to them.
The sandal that your mom throws at you when she's mad. They're a weapon of discipline in Latino households.
Yeah.
Yes.
I might have to hunt down and get a baseball hat from that farm team.
They had, and they had all the merch that was very
Then there was a, like a fuzzy mascot that looked nothing like a flip-flop. It was terrifying. It looked like, you know, Grover and the Grouch, like, went into the fly transporters and merged, and it was trying to get kids to love baseball.
Yes.
Oh, and we should probably note that all of this was filmed pre-pandemic. There's nothing in it that remotely addresses that at all.
Oh, no, not at all. There's really, I feel like there's not a lot more to say about it. I have in my notes, in conclusion, babies for some, miniature American flags for others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's time to go Around the dial.
The dial. We watched The Crown. We powered through it, 10 episodes in 2 days, because they rudely dropped it on Sunday instead of Friday. Like they normally
Yeah, what
do.
The fuck?
I just want to say I threatened to do this whole episode as Gillian Anderson doing Margaret Thatcher, but I was told I couldn't do it.
That's
Yeah,
true.
Thank you.
So this season, season four just dropped. It roughly covers the 80s. So the two big stories are Princess Diana and Margaret Thatcher. And all the pre-release coverage that I saw about Emma Corrin's performance as Diana focused on the movement coaching that she got to capture that particular, like, tilt of the chin. Plus, our friend Catherine Van Arendock also yelled about the very good wigs, which, by the way, are very good. In fact, they are, especially on her more flattering versions of Diana's haircuts during this time, which, when you see real photos, don't look so cute from our contemporary perspective. But anyway, I don't think her performance is very good. Dave, would you agree?
Yeah, it was kind of like I will play a wounded animal for six episodes or whatever. Like,
yeah,
it was not nuanced.
No, I look forward
it
to
was
Elizabeth.
Not nuanced.
Elizabeth, stop. Elizabeth Debicki is taking over soon. I hope next season. So part of it is that this actor Emma Corrin has to go from a 16-year-old, which is how old she was when she met Charles, to basically like a bitter, fucked over wife in the course of the season. And I think she's more convincing at the end, at the beginning, than she is at the beginning. But there's one particular shot in the third episode when she and Charles are announcing their engagement to the press and they're getting photographed. And the camera just focuses on her face. And she's doing this like nonstop cycle through a bunch of different versions of like a simpering, like shy ducking. And like, it should not have made the final cut. It's embarrassingly bad. I've already seen it as a meme on Twitter with like me on a Zoom meeting pretending to know what everyone is talking about, which is what it looks like. It's so bad. The sidelong looks, and admittedly, like that's kind of what Diana was doing generally at this point in her life, but still, it's not good acting. It's not good. The other thing that hampers Corrin is that Peter Morgan, who is the creator of the show, seems to hate Diana. Hate her. We obviously know that he is a monarchist sycophant, or he would not have made this show, but his sympathies are with Charles, like, from the start. I don't know how many versions of the scene between him and Camilla we see of him being like, I want to be with you, and someone being like, you can't. Like, 1,000? Anyway, all the attempts to portray Diana's loneliness or Charles's resentment at being pushed into marrying her in the first place and then being forbidden again from ending the marriage, even though they're both miserable.
And it happens so many times. Like, that's the problem with this season. It's very,
so
very on repeat. And it felt like they could have cut 2 episodes.
For sure.
Plus, we already saw this issue with Margaret. Like,
Yes. Yeah. And then that also comes back again, too, because all of the other members of the family like gradually also start to resent Diana because she's, you know, just drawing all of the press attention. All the press just loves her and doesn't care about anyone else anymore. Anyway, Morgan also makes Diana out to be like a thirsty fame whore, basically. He seems to share Charles's contempt for her, including toward what seemed to be genuine efforts on her part to do cute, if like dorky gestures to make him happy, like a little dance routine at some performance and, you know. She puts herself on tape singing a song from Phantom of the Opera, which is like, yeah, it's cringy, but she's doing it for him and he like just hates it. Do I think Diana seemed kind of annoying? Yes. Sorry that she's dead. Whatever. But she became the people's princess for a reason. And there doesn't seem to be enough acknowledgement by Morgan that part of why she sought that affirmation from the world is that when her husband wasn't ignoring her, he was emotionally abusing her. And he was also a victim of emotional abuse, which is in the show a little, but that is a reason, not an excuse. And since the season also tells us he was in therapy, apparently that therapy was not working very well. So what? Speaking of things that didn't work, Margaret Thatcher as prime minister. I knew Peter Morgan was a Tory as well as a monarchist. So before this season, I went back and forth worrying about how badly this season was going to whitewash Thatcher as PM because of that, and hoping that because they had cast Gillian Anderson to play her, that she would find ways to infuse Thatcher with villainy, no matter what the writing did. And I can't quite decide whether what came through was because of her. Like, there's basically only one episode that touches on the damage that her austerity policies wrought. It's our one annual episode through the eyes of a commoner.
Right.
Which was one of the better ones, I thought. It revolves around the story of a guy who broke into Buckingham Palace twice and actually got all the way into the Queen's bedroom to, like, talk to her about how much Margaret Thatcher sucked. And then there's another episode that tells the story of Thatcher's opposition to sanctioning South Africa over apartheid, but it's through the lens of, like, the rift that it caused between her and the Queen. But the rest of the time, Peter Morgan is basically giving Margaret Thatcher, like, a girl boss edit that makes it seem like she and the Queen are just, like, two extraordinary women in an extraordinary time who had, like, differences of style. And, like, Thatcher's last scene is after her own party turfs her for being such a shitty prime minister that the entire rest of the world is like, she's got to go. And so the Queen has her come to the palace and gives her this whole speech that's like, we didn't always agree, but I know what it's like to be surrounded by dumb old fat men who don't want to enact your agenda. And I respect your service to your country, like the fucking country that she spent 11 years gutting in every meaningful way. And then the Queen gives her a medal. Like, it's so gross and awful. I realize this is not a season about her, but she was a really bad prime minister and person.
In past seasons, I thought they did a better job of showing how they sort of crisscross. And this one felt much more forced.
Yeah.
Like, I get the impression from history that there was very little that Margaret Thatcher really gave a shit about when it came to the monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of it was just appearances, but she didn't really care about that too much either.
Right.
And I felt like they really sort of artificially amped up the importance of royal opinion in politics when it came across Thatcher's, you know, desk, as it were.
Right.
Because at certain episodes, it felt like, am I watching, like, the Iron Lady show, or watching The Crown?
Right.
Like, it really seemed so divorced from any interconnectivity that I was like, okay, again, two, you know, episodes you can cut from this, maybe three now, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, the way the show makes it seem like she was more than anything else a victim of misogyny is, like, ahistorical and also what we learned. Well, whatever. I won't get into right-wing shitbags weaponizing the language of identity politics to give cover to their shitty positions, but it's shitty. Alana Bennett, our past and I hope future guest of this podcast, tweeted this week, listen, watching the Kardashians and watching The Crown are functionally the same. And she's not wrong. That said, we devoured, as I said, all 10 episodes in 2 days. Made Me Mad is extremely watchable, as always, nevertheless. Now, did you have more to say before?
Yeah, I just thought it was the weakest season so far.
I agree.
And partly because I kind of know a little bit about it because I lived through
That's the thing.
But also, like, the further you get in time, the less important the royals are and the less interesting they become.
Right.
Like, at least at the start of it, there was a real connection between the patriotic feelings in the country and going to war and the monarchy. And there was a lot of consequences that came out of that synergy.
Yes.
And now it's just like they're just celebrities, right? Like,
right.
It really is. They are just, like, you know, well-behaved Kardashians. Like.
Right, which is what the Diana story is supposed to point out. But they also keep trying to have people do, like, well, you're supposed to do this and that. Like, have the common people say that to them. And it's like, you don't buy it, really. Anyway, now for the biggest chasm from my high pick to my low pick.
Uh-huh.
Candyland. The Food Network made a game show out of Candyland, as in the board game for children. It is hosted by Kristen Chenoweth.
Can I just, before you get into it, just, like, give a quick experience? Because I came into it, Tara was watching probably halfway through an episode.
Yeah.
It just seemed like Calvin Ball to me, you know, where Calvin Hobbs are playing a game and, like, there's rules you don't understand. And at the end of it, it was like 14 to Q was the score. Like, it was so busy.
It is.
So many things were happening. I'm like, it was like watching Great British Bake Off if they were all like on LSD.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a cooking show, obviously. It's on the Food Network. It has contestants are experienced, so it's not like a nailed it situation. These are like pastry chefs, sugar artists, chocolatiers, food sculptors, etc. The gimmick is that the set is a life-sized Candyland board where basically everything is edible, and the contestants source all of the ingredients they use down to, like, a cup of sugar from the set. So I tweeted a picture yesterday. Molly Lambert, also a past guest, said it was like some Sid and Marty Krofft shit, which it is. Yeah. Watching it made me feel like I'd been eating candy all day and gotten a headache from blood sugar spikes.
Yeah.
It was definitely made during the pandemic, judging from what we see of the footage of the designers putting the set together, because they're all in masks. But given that the chefs are just walking all over the set, including on stuff that may later be used in a recipe, I would have liked to see more gloves, shoe covers, and hairnets, personally. Anyway, the first challenge was they were each assigned a land of Candyland, and they had to make a creature that would live in that land. And they're working in teams, and like, four of them, it was clear from the result that this was like designed by committee, because each part of it looked like it was made by a different person, except for the winning team. It looked good. All the rest of them looked like shit. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. They were pretty bad.
They were terrible. Their version of Exile Island is sending the loser of a mid-challenge, mini-challenge to Licorice Lagoon. And she had to do a punishment that was dished out by Lord Licorice.
Yeah. And it's right out of a country fair.
Like, yes, she's digging that. In a cauldron of black licorice and what looked like molasses to find five pieces of red licorice and then hand them to Kristen Chenoweth. I don't want to see that again. So this instruction comes in a scroll from Lord Licorice, which, like, the mid-challenge...
Who, by the way, just to put it all together, was on The Crown.
I will say, so there's Lord Licorice as a character off screen. King Candy is a character off screen. Why would you go this hard on the theme and not cast Lord Licorice and King Candy, or at the very least get costumes for them and make Kristen Chenoweth be them?
Do
I have to do everything? Anyway, it's insane. I'm absolutely going to keep watching, because we established when I talk about Supermarket Sweep, I'm a dumb bitch. Those are my around the dials for this week.
Hold on. So why isn't, first of all,
yes,
what the board game that is Candyland,
which I probably played once in my life.
I was going to ask what it is. It's just like a roll of dice and move ahead kind of game, like
it's
a 40s,
kids.
50s board game.
Yes.
It's very
simple. Shoots and ladders situation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the show they should have done. Sort of the same idea.
Save it, because we have an extra hot great topic about this next week.
Yeah. No. I'm not going to change another show. I'm just going to change this show.
Okay.
It's just like, have the kids eat candy all the time and make the kids the contestants.
Ah.
And have them go fucking bazoo and just show the chaos and the carnage. And like, at the end of it, they're like, what do you make? And like, nothing. And their face is just like full of chocolate and they're mad.
So it's like Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah.
There's going to be barfing in the show. I'm not going to watch that. Just tell you.
The floor is lava, but it's chocolate.
For my plug, I reviewed for Primetimer a new show on Netflix called We're the Champions, which is an anthology show about different weird, unique competitions around the world, like an extreme hair show, cheese chasing, frog jumping, dog dancing, etc. It's kind of fun. If it's like I said, people who like Making It or Ted Lasso will probably vibe with it. Mm. So you can read my review at Primetimer. We will link it in the show notes.
Omar, it is your turn.
I saw a show called That Animal Rescue Show. It's on CBS All Access, and it is exactly what it sounds like. It is about animal rescues, but it takes place in around Central Texas. I don't think it gets too far afield beyond kind of the Austin, San Antonio area where some of us live. And what's most interesting about it, I think, is that Richard Linklater is the co-creator. He's never really done... Yeah, he hasn't done much TV. This is really his first big TV project in a really long time. Dr. Phil McGraw is one of the producers, but I don't think he's creatively involved. I think it's just his production company. And it's really good. It's very emotional. I interviewed Richard Linklater for the paper over here, and you know, talking to him, it's exactly what you would expect from him, from his movies. I mean, it's very full of human stories. It's very sweet and well-meaning and emotional. And the first episode broke me. I cried over the first episode, which featured literally a dog who can only eat standing up. And I was like, oh my God, I started bawling. And my kid,
I think I might have seen pictures of it. Do they have like a special, like, a container box for them?
Yes, he has to stand up in a wooden box so he can eat. It's so sad. Anyway, so things like that.
I can't watch the show. No way.
Well, I can't either. Well, that's the thing. The first episode is like that. It's a lot of very tragic stories. And the second episode goes, and the second and third episodes Linklater actually directed himself, are a pig pageant. And that's totally not tragic or sad. It's really funny and sweet and very Austin. I mean, it's very... Keep Austin weirdy, you know, that might be grating to some people, but it's very good. And it kind of goes further afield from that. There's a bat rescue. There's cow rescues. It's not all, you know, dogs and cats. It's a lot of different farm animals and kind of goes a little bit further around the state. But it has a very Austin vibe to it. All the music in the show is from Austin artists. It has that sort of Richard Linklater through line about how people affect animals and how animals affect people. So it's definitely worth a watch. It's beautifully filmed. It's well told, great human stories. Even if you're not an animal lover, there's really a cool kind of human component to it of not just helping the animals, but the animals helping humans kind of, you know, figure out their emotions or get over trauma. It's really remarkable. So it's only 10 episodes. I don't know that they're going to do another season because all of this was filmed pre-pandemic and there's no plans to do another one of these, but it's all on, I guess, Paramount or CBS All Access.
What's it called?
It is kind of interesting, though, how they responded to COVID and how they like successfully came up with a system that works really well, really quickly. Like the fostering system kicked into high gear. I feel like almost on day two of people realizing that this wasn't going away. And like, it's really successful because at the start of it, remember, like you were like, maybe we should foster a dog. And they're like, oh, they're all gone.
Yep.
And they're like, you know, all the dogs are fostered. They're somewhere safe now and they're not in kennels. I'm like, oh, wow. All right. Yep. And then like the greater area in Austin. I was like, okay, good.
Yep.
Yeah. And the show was sort of sparked from Richard Linklater rescuing a pig himself. And now he's got four pigs roaming around outside his house. And it's a really cool, that's what kind of got him involved in the animal community and rescue community. And he really, you can tell just by the way the show is made that he loves these people. He loves what they're doing. He loves, you know, putting a spotlight on people that are just, you know, humbly helping animals and not in it for any kind of, you know, personal gain or exploiting animals, which they're very careful to skirt around. But yeah, that animal rescue show.
I would pay a moderate amount of good money non-exploitatively if I can get a pig and my dogs in the same yard for a little bit to see what would happen.
As long as it was a big enough pig that it could
not like a little piglet. No, I mean, I don't mean like they would fight. I'm just like, because Gordon would be like interested, but like confused.
What are you?
Yeah, and I think if it was the same size as Murray, there would be some interesting interactions there. I would enjoy that.
This is how I feel about getting a goat. It's like, we need to test this. It's like, let's have a kid. That kind of kid.
Oh, there's...
Okay.
The one good thing about The Crown is there was a very cute baby goat. One of
there was. I think it was a lamb.
Oh, a lamb, right. Yeah.
What are your plugs, Omar?
Oh, okay. For my plug, I did a couple of stories recently about stand-up comedy, about just sort of how it's slowly kind of coming back in certain parts of the country. Definitely not in New York or L.A., where everything is pretty shut down for live comedy. But in Texas and other places, there's starting to be a lot of outdoor shows and a lot of small, you know, spread out club shows indoors. Your mileage may vary on that. But anyway, I did a story just about all of the alternatives to that, too, like Zoom comedy and for a site called Book and Film Globe. You can find that story there. And then I interviewed Steve Trevino, who is, I've known him for like 15, 20 years. He's been a stand-up comic for a long, long time. Very, very good comedian. He has a new special out called My Life in Quarantine, which he filmed outdoors in Texas. He lives here in town where I live. And he filmed this special and it's very, very good. It also includes a podcast recording as sort of bonus content. He started a podcast with his wife in quarantine at home. And that's part of the special. But I think it just went offline. It was available for rent and it's just about to, I think, broaden to other services. So just look on his website, stevetrevino.com. It's My Life in Quarantine. And I did an interview with him and a larger story about stand-up comedy.
Have you done the Zoom comedy thing? Because I feel like that would be really awkward experience, but have you done it?
I watched one that was like a trivia, like a kind of like a stand-up show and then a trivia thing that like a group Zoom trivia where you put you typed your answers in. And the comedy was awkward because it was all the comedians were in their homes, you know, just kind of doing apartment comedy. And the trivia was intriguing because it was like it was live and it was very chaotic and the host was just trying to keep it together. I think his name was Ben Glebe. I think is
his
name.
Oh, yeah, I know that name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, it's Nowhere Comedy Club, and he does these Zoom trivia shows. So I paid to watch it. It was like $10. And I was like, this is interesting. Like, I felt like I at least got my money's worth. It was only $10, and I got to see three or four comedians and do a trivia show. So that was, yeah, it can work. I could see how people would find it awkward.
Sarah DeBundick.
Awkward things that don't work. Law and Order SVU. Oh my God. It's back. Mm. And it's trying to hit every single headline from the last 6 to 8 months, which, like, okay. I tweeted last week, what if Isaac and Ishmael, but even clumsier and propaganda? And I should probably just leave it there. If you understand the reference, great. If you don't, en conclusion, no.
Yeah.
But, oh my God, where to even start if I don't leave it there? Like, we might begin with how much time the squad is spending unmasked in hospitals. We might note that a character who is Amy Cooper tells the cops that she's, quote, not one of those Karens. We might pity Ice-T for having to say of Benson that, quote, her only bias is for the victim. And Damore Barnes for having to utter the following line about cops of color, quote, we're both black and blue.
No!
Yes! There is, it won't surprise you to learn, a heapin' helpin' of Liv's smeary cry face, and nobody asked or would ever fucking ask for a fucking Socratic mommy are you a racist dialogue with goddamn Noah. But because you live in the world, you know that's in there as well. The show is trying to have it both ways. It has tried to have it both ways many times before, including when Amaro shot some kid in the back in an entryway. And actually, the only part worth keeping of this stupid episode is the part where an internal affairs investigator shits all over Amaro for doing this. Amaro often was at the center of stories in which SVU attempted to seem woke while still siding with the cops. Look, you're a cop show, okay? It's your 22nd season. Again, we all live in the world, and it's the second half of 2020. But if you're going to take the position that your heroes still merit rooting for and watching every week, enough with the fucking performative self-inventory. Start modeling some fucking mask wearing, especially with your boy Carisi, who is from Staten Island, where positive rates are at, like, 8%, and get back in the lane you can drive worth a fraction of a damn, namely, for instance, the difficulties of prosecuting anything during this lockdown, never mind sexual assault investigation, or what domestic violence investigations and prosecutions look like when everyone is stuck inside together. I understand that the show's demographic is a bunch of oldish white ladies, like myself, that the executive producer and star is a middle-aged white lady, and everybody wants to feel good about how unracist they are. But please, with the obnoxious horseshacking for extra capital G getting it credit that even 5 seconds on Twitter could have told the writer's room is not going to work. Never mind all of that. It's just bad television. Like, when the biggest problem in a Noah scene isn't its own existence, just stop. Be a cop show or cancel yourself. If we want, Goofus doesn't acknowledge his unconscious bias. We know how to Google highlights for children. Thank you and goodbye. Yes, I'm going to continue hate watching this. Are there any questions?
No, that covers it. What I read on Twitter was that, like, everyone has masks on, but then when they get close to talk to people, they take them down. Ah. Yeah, how masks work.
Yeah, I saw a guy walk by me in HEB, which is the grocery store, yesterday. Got a phone call and immediately, like, put the phone to his face and pulled down his mask. Like, you can't talk through a mask.
Yeah.
Like, dude.
No.
And, like, you feel like in the moment you're justified in saying something, but you know if you do, it's not going to do anything.
No.
At best, and at worst, you're going to get told off or, you know, whatever, make a scene. Yeah.
Shot.
Yeah, shot. Yeah, yeah. Right. Good point, actually.
It's Texas.
Yeah. Sometimes I forget where I live.
Yeah.
That's what I like about Texas.
Boom, 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 boom.
I mean, you live in the Brooklyn of Texas. I live in the Texas of Brooklyn.
Right.
I hear you. Yeah. Okay, so my plug, speaking of getting shot, on Quaid and Full season 3, episode 5, which will be out as you're listening to this tomorrow, we are talking about Suspect with our esteemed colleague, John Ramos, who is guesting on the program. Once again, Quaid and Full, that's me and Jeb Lund watching every single Quaid property, Dennis, not Randy, in chronological order. We're in the sort of mid to late 80s right now. It's about to get gnarly, but the movies we're watching right now are pretty good. Once again, Suspect. John Ramos will be our guest. That's Quaid in Full, wherever you get podcasts, but we'll link to it in the show notes. Woo.
This is off topic, but, well, it'll explain why I have nothing for Around the Dial this week. That is that I had a very bad week about a week ago. Health-wise, things were happening.
Be vague.
That's all I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
But while this was happening, I had to go for my citizenship quiz. Not the swearing in, but just like to
the interview.
Yeah, the interview. And it's not really even an interview. Well, they're just like checking notes and making you answer ridiculous questions about America. Like, what did Susan B. Anthony do? These are my questions. What did Susan B. Anthony do? What did Martin Luther King do? Where is the Statue of Liberty? Mm-hmm. What is one of the branches of government? These are the types of questions.
Wow.
Yeah. Win the election.
Even actual Americans could pass that.
I also got Martin Luther King.
And actually, they say if you're over a certain age and you've lived in America for, you don't even have to answer those. They're like, eh, you've been here long enough. You probably know them. I bet they don't. It was just a weird week. And yeah, it was weird because I was very sick answering questions about America in order to be able to become a citizen. And all that happened the day after the election. So right. It was like,
it was 2 days after.
Do I want to really do this? Am I like...
It hadn't been called yet. This was Thursday.
It hadn't been called. And then sometimes you hear that when you take their quiz, they're like, well, go in the next room. We'll swear you're in. I'm like, no, not that. Do the one where you have to wait a little bit, please. Anyway, America. Coming up on this podcast. On the next Extra, Extra Hot, Great Suh, we've got TV grudges, the things that made you mad once upon a time, no matter how big or small, that are still sticking in your craw. Mm-hmm. And then the one after that will be Showify My Board Game.
Inspired by Candyland. That's my topic.
Mm-hmm. That is available to all supporters of any level. And you could find us there at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Then on the next EHG Prime, we've got Supernatural. We're actually going to talk about Supernatural because apparently it hasn't ended and it's going to be ending.
Yes, it's the series.
Gun to my head, finale. I would have said it ended 2.5 years ago. Like, I'm serious. Like, I thought
it was 14
done.
Seasons, or how many seasons is that?
This is season 15, I believe.
And holy moly.
Whenever it's mentioned, you joke about how long it's been on, but I swear I thought it was over a long time ago. Apparently that has not yet happened.
Yeah.
And because it is Supernatural,
it's a very special, special event.
For one, Mademoiselle Caroline. So we're going to ask Mademoiselle Caroline to come on the show to talk about Supernatural and a bunch of other things. Her one request is that we could, no idiomatic game times because she has problems with that. So there will be no pun-filled game times in that episode, but it's going to be a very interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah. Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Suli. It is called Indignant Jack McCoy. Speaking of the Law & Order franchise, he writes, in honor of Law & Order streaming on Peacock, seasons 13 to 20 anyway, what is a situation you want Jack McCoy to go on an indignant rant about? Whom would it be to, and where would it occur? I'm thinking he's at a bodega in New York. One patron isn't wearing a mask, and Jack immediately begins orating to a fast-forming crowd. Normally, I would go to our guest first, but since this is Sarah's area of expertise, Sarah, start us off.
Well, I think that he's in a bakery looking for an oatmeal cookie that contains perhaps a butterscotch chip or no chips or other items at all. Mm-hmm. Naturally, because of Big Raisin, he finds only oatmeal cookies with raisins in them. Mm-hmm. as the devil intended.
Yep.
Cut to a like tortious interference lawsuit with the cello of opprobrium playing while he's ranting about the state of New Jersey versus throwing up and how it clearly captured the framers' Eighth Amendment intent with regard to oatmeal cookies, namely that compulsory inclusion of raisins constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. No urine contempt of cookies, strenuous objections, motion to dismiss the Sun Maid, etc., and so on. Omar.
First of all, Sarah's wrong about raisin.
Shut up, oatmeal Dave.
No.
Omar. They're delicious.
No.
Raisins have a place in bakery.
Wrong.
No, they don't.
Omar is. No, Omar.
Omar.
I'm Omar Raisin Gallega. You're next.
I'm Raisin Switzerland here. I have no position on raisins.
Switzerland.
Omar is the Apple TV of this panel.
Thanks, Dave.
Wow.
So I guess I think I was hungry when I was pondering this because it came back to food again. But I was thinking like sort of like a food tourist cop, like berating any tourist who tries to eat at like a chain restaurant or tries to eat at like a Pizza Hut instead of actual New York pizza, or, you know, is eating the pizza with a fork and a knife, you know, like any kind of crimes against New York food, telling them to burn, you know, to over toast the bagel and no spread. Like, no, that's not how you eat it. So like just sort of like any kind of food patrol I'd be into.
I think we can add New York slices to that one. Like, you know, has to be served on the paper plate. The paper plate has to be sufficiently greasy before you take your first bite.
It's like 70% saturation.
Yeah.
Well, I also went into the food space, guys. It's been several years since McDonald's made their breakfast menu available all day. But during the pandemic, some locations have quietly reverted to the old restrictions on when these items are actually served. That's right. Good old Jack McCoy rolls up to the drive-thru at 11:15 and isn't feeling a cheeseburger quite yet. What's he going to do when he hears he missed his window to get a McGriddle? He's going to subject the poor high school junior at the other end of the talk box, who's just trying to save up for a Vespa, to a stem winder on the social contract, the compact between merchant and customer, and the artificiality of a system that would tell a DA he's not allowed to eat brunch on the go. Dave,
I have a question. Is there like some contractual reason why seasons 1 to 12 are not on Peacock with the others? Like, are they still in syndication somewhere or something like that? Oh, okay.
All right. Well, and here's a weird thing. All of a sudden now they're on BBC America.
They've always been on BBC America, I think.
Have
they're
they?
Part of the, yeah, because they're owned by the same company that owns like Wii and Sunday and stuff. They're all
I just never
the
noticed
same.
Them until recently. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Sorry. Continue.
No, it's up. Dave is up next.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays.
Uh-oh.
Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
This is not to do with the actual subject of this extra credit, but now that was brought up, I am not a crackpot, but the world should declare streaming amnesty where all the rights go back to who they're supposed to go to so that the people that created the content can put the whole fucking thing on their streaming service.
Yes.
Or put it on there to begin with. We sold such and such movie rights to some small distribution company in the UK. Therefore, you cannot watch this movie anywhere in the UK. You have to buy it from iTunes. Fuck that. You pay that company, you know, $30,000 or whatever it is to make them shut up. You get that movie. All this can happen. You got like 1 year to settle all this shit out. Then everybody has all their movies and all their TV show episodes available, you know, across probably 5 or 6 major streaming platforms, but you know they're going to be there, and you don't have to guess that episodes 2 to 4 of 5 are on streaming platform A, and then the rest are on B, but except for the last season, which is on C, and it's only available in fucking Malaysia or something like that. Like, amnesty.
Yeah.
Feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Isn't that what's happening with the Great British Baking Show? Aren't there those seasons all scattered all over the place?
Yeah.
Yep. Mm.
Okay.
Sorry.
I feel bad I didn't come up with the food one. I was thinking, I came up with a slightly serious one where I was imagining Jack McCoy trying to hail a cab with Robinette there, and he's trying to figure out why he can't hail a cab. Because that was born out of my real dumb one, which is like Jack McCoy gets indignant about the cab lights, which I always was confused about all the time I lived in New York. And I remember they even passed a law while I was still living in New York that they had to do like a certain, like, because they were like fudging when they were off duty and when they're on duty. And like somebody explains to me, when the light's on, it means they're actually going to pick you up. It's like, what? But it says off duty. It's like, nah, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, So, you know, he can get mad on my behalf on sure. that. And then, I don't know, for food, like maybe like picking up on Sarah's thing, like there's now black and white and blue cookies and everybody's mad about that.
Is that real?
No, I hope not. I hope not. I mean, probably in, if they are, they're in Staten.
Yep.
All right. Ad break here.
Oh, God. They probably are real.
I bet they're real.
It's black. Yeah, and as soon as you said that.
There's a stripe of blue.
No
going
doubt.
Down.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. God. Ugh.
All cookies matter.
You flip the back and it says, don't tread on me.
God damn it.
Oh, what am I doing? Oh, yeah.
This will cheer us all up.
Be in the show.
This will cheer us all
up. Okay, here we go. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Tar Ariano presenting this week.
When people like my esteemed colleague Sarah say they don't like sitcoms, it's often a generalization that I think doesn't quite describe what they mean. And if I may counter with a generalization of my own, what I think tends to rankle them about sitcoms are things like a tone that's overly arch or glib, characters who all sound the same, which is to say like a white guy who graduated from Harvard, episodes that are built around expected, if not hoary, situations, or just a vague feeling that the people who made the show have contempt for their audience or their characters or both. These conditions certainly are present in a lot of bad sitcoms, but they are not universal to the genre. And if you don't believe that before this week, I hope you will after we're done talking about season one, episode 6 of Joe Pera Talks With You, titled Joe Pera Reads You the Church Announcements. Dave and I have talked about the show on Around the Dial before. It's a live-action Adult Swim sitcom, so most episodes are around 11 minutes long. It was created by and stars the titular Joe Pera. In actuality, Joe Pera is a stand-up comic and writer, but on the show, he's a middle school choir teacher in his lifelong hometown of Marquette on Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Joe's life is characterized by its routine and stability. In previous episodes, Joe Pera showed you iron and took you to breakfast, for example. But there is still space in that life for excitement and wonder, as in this episode we are discussing today. Here's what I think makes it canon-worthy. Number one, it showcases Joe's essential wholesomeness. The story begins, as the title indicates, with the church announcements, which we'll circle back to. But the main thrust of the episode is a thrilling moment of discovery Joe experienced several days earlier. Clip one.
I was in my kitchen doing my kitchen chores, and I was listening to this classic rock station because my hands were soaked and I couldn't change the channel.
All right, it's about 10 minutes after 9 and the snow's really falling. So to all you out there in winter wonderland, stay warm. Keep on listening to the only classic rock music station in Marquette, 102.1 WKUP.
What the listener can't see is that Joe's hands are soapy because he is meticulously hand-washing his dishes before placing them in the dishwasher, which in itself tells us a lot about this character. But while he is obviously a straight-laced normie, he's at home alone after dinner and is still wearing a button-down and a pullover sweater under his festive Christmas apron, he can't help being moved by the song, approvingly nodding along with the bass line. There's a jump cut to the end of the track, and then we see Joe, now so keyed up that his feet are doing little tippy taps, calling into the radio station, thirsty for knowledge. Clip two.
WKUP, you're on the air.
What was that song you just played?
Yeah, good one. You got a pen and paper handy there, pal?
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay, well, the name of the song is Bobo.
Uh-huh.
All right, it's not Teenage Wasteland, even though they
say Teenage Wasteland 100 times and Bob O'Reilly 0 times. I guess if you write a song that good, you could give it whatever
dumbass title you want.
Okay.
And the name of the group is The Who. All right? The Who, that's what they're called. Jot that down so we don't get into a
goddamn Abbott and Costello routine over here, all right?
Thank you very much. Could you please play it again?
Come on, Chewy.
Sorry, pal.
I'd love to, but some guy just requested Jeremy by Pearl Jam, so...
Okay, I'll try another station.
Could also look it up online, but whatever you want to do. Anyway, thanks for listening, all right?
In addition to being a gentle soul inflamed by the power of rock and roll, Joe is a man out of time who literally does not hear the DJ's suggestion that he just look up the song anywhere on the internet, because he's too busy calling another radio station to ask if they will play Bob O'Reilly. Joe still lives in the same town he did when he was a kid. He still has the same haircut he did when he was a kid, I assume. And he's still solving problems the way he did when he was a kid. And to be fair, it does work. Number two, it shows Joe wilding out. This is, of course, unclippable for an audio podcast, but the character we've just seen pre-washing his dishes gets his version of turnt. He has one glass of wine and... dances with his basset hound, Gus, runs through the house twirling a scarf like a soccer hooligan, plays every classroom instrument in his home music room, eats ice cream out of the pail and then throws a scoop right in the sink, tears Kleenex out of the box and drops it on the floor, jumps on his living room furniture, carefully replaces a lampshade before dragging the pizza guy in to join him. By the time we see Joe at church, he is still on one. Clip three.
And that's it. I've been a Who fan ever since, and I've been up for 3 days straight listening to the new Who song. Sorry to ramble, but I also had another first this morning. I finally tried Starbucks coffee. A little fancy for my taste, but boy, do I feel alive.
When you know a TV character well, you may have the same feeling of tenderness toward him when he does something extremely typical as when he does something extremely unexpected. Joe's apparently hours-long Baba O'Reilly dance break is somehow both. Number three, it showcases the wholesomeness of the show's setting. I said I would circle back to this. We open on church announcements during Advent, no less. Clip four.
The holidays are coming up, and the Roy P. Schimmelmacher toy drive will take place from December. I'm sorry. Have you guys heard the Who? They rock. They're unbelievable. I heard them for the first time on Thursday, and I haven't slept since.
If this was the first episode you ever saw, you might think this outburst is the sort of thing that Wacky Joe does all the time. The rest of the congregation is completely unperturbed by it, certainly, until we cut to him at home in his kitchen and you realize, oh, okay, no, this was a very even-keeled individual until the Who unlocked something primal inside him. But Joe's correct apprehension that his church is a safe place to express his excitement about Baba O'Reilly is, we see, consistent with how safe Marquette seems to be in general. The first DJ he calls, for example, seems to think Joe is doing a bit when he calls to ask about the song, but he gives him accurate information and doesn't roast him for not knowing what the song is despite its being close to 50 years old. Every other radio DJ in town is perfectly happy to play the track for him when he calls to request it, including, one imagines, any all-talk stations he tries when he exhausts the others. Joe's Nana, who, if she liked this kind of music, presumably would have played it for him sometime before this, cheerfully lets the Who provide the soundtrack as they decorate the Christmas tree together. And when the priest, probably incorrectly, claims he hasn't heard the song before, Joe's fellow parishioners gamely join Joe in trying to jog his memory. Clip five.
It goes... bum, bum, bum. Out here in the field, I fight for my meal. I get my back into my living. I don't need to fight to prove I'm right. I don't need to be forgiven.
Like I said, I have not heard that song before. Joe, why don't you go back to your seat?
Okay.
Set a spell. The rest of the announcements you can read in the bulletin.
Joe's Marquette is the kind of place where Marquette's Joe can thrive. And even the Killjoy priest refusing to play along with the gag is an integral part of making a quirky TV small town three-dimensional. And yes, I know Marquette is a real place. It just probably isn't really like this. Number four, Joe is definitely enthusiastic, but that doesn't mean he's uncritical. Clip six.
Maybe I just don't get it, but it seems like they realized they had written the perfect song and then panicked. So then they added a violin solo. What do I know?
An earlier episode closes with Joe saying that he and his best friend Gene, who is black, are suing each other to learn about the legal system, also to determine if there's racial bias in the courts. And I feel like it's this spirit of curiosity and drive toward analysis that sparks Joe's critique of the end of Baba O'Reilly. Then again, listening to one song on repeat for 3 days straight could turn anyone into a musicologist. Joe Para reads you the church announcements, obviously is not the pilot of Joe Para Talks With You, as we've established, but in the way that it epitomizes both Joe's character and the place that made him, I feel like it could be. Let's get together before you get much colder and agree that it belongs in the canon.
Thank you, Tara. Omar, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I discovered this show because of you guys and love it. It's I've seen both seasons and adore it. I made my kids watch it against their will, and then they began to love it because it's one of those shows that kind of sneaks up on you. I think when you first start watching it, there's this tension because you think that it's going to be cringy or that the joke's going to be on him somehow, that he's sort of like a fish out of water. There's going to be something's going to happen to him that shows what a goofball he is or something. And that moment never comes. There's no like ironic thing happening. It's a very sincere show about a sweet person who admires and loves all the people around him. And there's no irony to it. It's very, very sincere. So, and I think this episode is a particularly good entry point because it's a little more high energy and more overtly humorous than a lot of the other episodes that are much more subtle. So I think for someone who's not familiar with Joe Para, who doesn't know that his rhythms, which are very grandfather rhythms, like he speaks and moves like a grandpa, and that's sort of part of the joke, but it's not a joke at him, it's just the character. I think this episode in particular is great because it kind of gives you more overt humor while introducing you to him, and then the other episodes that are a little bit slower or a little bit lower energy, a lot lower energy, kind of wash over you. It's one of those shows that you don't really know what to make of it at first, and then the longer it goes and the more episodes you watch, you just completely fall in love with his town and with Joe Para. It's a beautiful, beautiful show.
I think we've been trained when you first watch Joe Para to think he's a man child, right?
Yes.
That's the expectation that pop culture has given us.
Yep.
When we're introduced to that character, but it's not.
No.
He is not worldly. Right? Like he's not cosmopolitan.
Yes.
But he is his own person. He's fully formed and he's not dumb. He's not immature. He just has a voyage of discovery.
He's extremely
episode
earnest.
After episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Sarah. Yeah, I think that Tara's sort of opening salvo, I don't care for sitcoms. And the fact is like 80% of them are everything that she described that was bad. So I just don't bother a lot of the time. But I think after more than two decades of working together, Tara tends to not inflict on me or suggest for me sitcoms that I'm going to react to violently. This was so interesting because like clearly there's all this thought about in the writing about what this song means, and there are little like stalking horses. Like I love how he just has the DJ say like, why the fuck is it called Baba O'Reilly anyway?
Yeah.
But then you also have the cultural baggage that the song brings in, which is that it's the soundtrack of this like climactic and fairly dark and fucked up scene in Summer of Sam. It was the theme song to CSI New York. It is what it is. And there's this very un-rock and roll person responding to it on the cellular level. But, you know, Omar's point that, like, it's funny, but the joke isn't at his expense is well taken. Like, everything about it is just, like, a little off balance. But once you sort of get used to the idea that this person is either incapable or unwilling to like Google things or to sort of exist in the present day. Like his basset hound is named Gus, but is wearing a pink ribbon. Okay. the woman just playing this giant drum so that she can be part of his joy. Okay. And I think it was epitomized in the scene at the end, which you clipped, where, like, you watch enough TV and you're sort of trained to expect, like, either they're going to leave him hanging and not sing along with him to prompt the priest, or they're going to come in at a certain time, and neither of those things happens. And they eventually, like, I was halfway through writing, like, are they really not going to back him up? And then they come in to back him up. And then there's that little, like, there's two people who do the, oh, yeah, which is so funny. I mean, this was like, I mean, this is unique. This is not something that you see much in terms of telling this kind of story in this way, in this sort of like welcoming way that is also, it's teasing, but it's not mean. So yeah, this was interesting. I never saw an episode before, and I'm going to have to dig into it, especially since they're like 10 minutes each. So
they're so short.
What's not to love?
It's a favorite thing a historian say that up to a certain relatively recent point in time, most people that ever lived never really traveled 15 miles away from where they were born.
Yeah.
And I feel like Joe Pera is like one of those people, right? He is a small town grandpa soul, and he knows what he likes, and he likes his routine, and he likes the people that he sees every day. He likes to go to get the same breakfast at, you know, the diner on the weekend and all that kind of stuff. And every episode, I feel like Joe Pera discovers something new, right? That's sort of the formula for most of these episodes. And whether it's about beans or it's about the Who, he has his little discoveries. And I mean, low key is a little bit of an undersell, you know, but it's or low energy just doesn't quite hit what I want to say perfectly. But, you know, it's not a boisterous show. So I would forgive you if you watch it. It's just not your cup of tea, because it definitely is not a universal sort of tone for something. But it is very different and very enjoyable if you can get into its rhythms, much like Joe Pera does in his life, actually. This episode sort of reminds me of one from season one. And I had to look up the title because I always forget what it is. With his, I think it's his girlfriend by then, Sarah Connor.
Sarah, yeah.
It's called Joe Pera Talks to You About the Rat Wars of Alberta, Canada, 1950 to the present day. And he creates this musical with Sarah.
She's the music teacher at the school where they both teach.
So the kids are going to put on this musical or this play about this government program that rid the province of rats.
Which is real.
Which is a real thing. And he's very fascinated by it. And it's not like super goofy and dumb. It's like got this earnest streak through it that really grounds everything in a way that makes Joe Pera so likable and huggable, but not man-child. I mean, that's where it is so deaf walking in between those two things, right? Like, well, it never disappoints you by making him the laughingstock of something.
Yeah, and I think part of that, the reason is that one of the other executive producers is Connor O'Malley, who plays the mechanic in this episode, who installs the CD player in his car.
I meant to mention that scene. Where are the kids? Lift number two.
Yeah.
Hi. Like, that's just another thing that's so unexpected that you'd expect this mom to freak out. And she's like, oh, hi.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, they and he, because his comic style is very different. He's very spiky. Like, when I found out that he was behind this, I was like, wow. Like, you would not think that they would mesh at all. But like, when his character, whose name is Mike, he comes up throughout the series. I think he's in almost every episode. But in the pilot, the premise is that Joe is going to show you iron, and then there's a knock on the door, and it's Mike and his family. Because they're there, there's a sign on Joe's lawn that says it's for sale, and they're there to tour the house. And Joe's like, well, my house is not for sale, but I guess if the sign is there, I have to show them my house. It sort of plays out from there. Like, it's an absurd premise, but it just rests on the fact that, like, Joe is so nice that he has to follow through on it. And Mike is a Connor O'Malley character in that he's more of a man-child. Yeah. Like,
he's sort of like the out-of-towner kind of thing.
Exactly.
He's sort of like the rest of the world coming into this little burg.
Yes.
And I feel like the key to understanding Joe Pera is that his world is the world until he expands his horizons a little bit each episode. And it sort of celebrates that rather than making that sort of, you know, the punching bag punchline time after time. And it's a very gentle but really funny way of approaching sort of a kind of a, not really a fish out of water, but relative to us, he's sort of like a fish out of water in society. Like this is sort of like trapped in time, out of phase sort of existence that he lives that is extremely enduring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is, I feel like, the most endearing episode.
I just started watching How To with John Wilson, I think on your recommendation, Tara. And
wasn't mine, but go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
I haven't watched it. I'm not against it. I just haven't watched it.
Oh, okay. Well, there you can kind of draw a straight line from that to this to Nathan For You, which all kind of think share the same, some of the same, I think Nathan Fielder's involved somehow.
Yes,
but
he's
but yeah, so there's sort of like a, there's a sort of deceptively high difficulty curve for a show like this, where it's all about the setting, getting the right tone, mm-hmm. where the humor is all about the tone. And if the tone is off, it's just not going to work. And I think all three of those shows managed to straddle that in a really interesting way. They're all distinct and different, and they all have different sort of joke density, but they all sort of have that in common, that it's just sort of tone based humor.
Yeah. And also they film grade it to make it look like it's kind of got a 70s Kodak kind of color scheme to it. And I think that helps. You know, it's obviously supposed to be today, but it looks sort of like the photos that your parents took of you, you know, back when. So it all contributes to it. And I guess just one last point about just Joe Pera living in Joe Pera's world. He refers to, he wants to hear the new song from The Who.
I know.
So it's new to him. So it has to be, you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't even like consider that it has been around for 50 years. So great episode. If you haven't watched it, give it a shot. I wouldn't blame you for, you know, if it's not your cup of tea, but if you can get into it, it is unlike anything else you've watched. So it's worth a try. Let's put this to the official vote. Omar.
Oh, yes, for sure.
Sarah.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing me to this finally. It's a yes for me.
And me too. So. That means Joe Pera Talks With You. Season 1, Episode 6, Joe Pera Reads You the Church Announcements. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Talk Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara, who is our winner?
Well, I mean, co-winners, I guess, are Alec Baldwin and Kelsey Grammer, who are teaming up for a sitcom from one of the co-executive producers of Modern Family. This will air on ABC and not, as you might guess, in hell. Emily Heller, who is a comedian, tweeted about this yesterday, quote tweeted Vulture's tweet, and adding, pray for the PAs on this set. I really can't improve on that because that's about how I feel. It's a lot of attitude to bring to a project, these two personalities. And the fact that Alec Baldwin is like, would describe himself as a mega liberal and Kelsey Grammer is a Republican is like probably not a problem because the two of them have what? Class solidarity because they're both rich assholes. So whatever political problems they may have are going to be, I'm sure, completely ironed out because of that. Gross. Will not watch. Sarah.
Speaking of gross, our loser of the week is COVID-related production shutdowns.
Yeah.
Let's start with something that wasn't shut down, namely the CMA Awards, which were sparking questions / backlash about the apparent precautions they didn't take the other night, with bands tweeting that they canceled at the last minute because of a positive test, like during the performances and people just wandering around maskless, like it's not good. But apparently from a marketing standpoint, I guess they felt the demographic wasn't gonna try to hear it, like, but just do it anyway because it's people's lives anyway. CBS Radford apparently, as Tara put it, riddled with COVID and shutting down three productions. including season two of Mythic Quest.
No.
Chicago Fire also shut down for 2 weeks after a positive test. Dear White People had several positive tests, and had to shut down production for a week.
Oh, hey, Sarah Bosch was on The Mandalorian this week.
He sure was.
Yeah, I heard that from a number of sources.
He plays Bosch.
Finally.
Space Bosch.
Hey, speaking about things set in space. Not really. Don't worry, Sarah. Do you know what time it is?
Space time?
Wait, I got one. Speaking about mystery shows, do you know what time it is?
Is it game time?
Game time.
Hey.
All right, welcome back to Game Time. It is the first Game Time of the season. Our crossover episode was not part of a regulation season. Today we are playing Revenge of the Cozy Mystery from Mr. Dan Cassino.
Oh, damn you, Cassino!
Who earns himself an extra credit. Topic. Dan writes, we've established that the Extra Hot Great Crew isn't the biggest fan of cozy mysteries, true. But given the multiple streaming services and long-running shows devoted to them, they should probably learn a little bit more about them. Sure. In this game, I will ask you a series of multiple-choice questions about various cozy murder mysteries and the tropes they tend to have in common. A correct answer gets you 1 point, and there are 24 questions and a tiebreaker if we need it.
Okay.
No steel meals today because it's a multiple-choice thing, so it doesn't really make sense to do it. And we're also going to skip Grossworth Ecologer Town Zones because we've got a lot of reading today, so we want to get into the questions. So let's just throw it to Piggy to see who is going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Our order today, Sarah, Omar, Tara, are we ready to play Revenge of the Cozy Mystery?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start with Sarah. Your first show is a co-production between Britain and France. The long-running Death in Paradise, filmed in beautiful Guadalupe, or we say here, Guadalupe, is problematic for a lot of reasons. Not among those is A, the locals are consistently portrayed as lazy and superstitious.
Oh dear.
B, British characters constantly making jokes about how bad French colonialism was. C, the island has to import a detective from the UK to run murder investigations because the local cops apparently can't be trusted with it. So is it A, portrayed as lazy and superstitious? B, how bad French colonialism was? Or C, have to import a detective? Which one is not among the problematic reasons presented in the show?
I think it's B.
Hey.
Correct. Those other things were true. They did portray everybody as lazy and superstitious.
Yeah, I was like, those sound horrible. They must be real. Boo.
To Omar. This is a British show. It is called Shakespeare and Hathaway. It concerns a pair of private detectives who solve crimes linked by what? A, they all take place in the twee town of Stratford-upon-Avon. B, all the crimes are based on Shakespeare's plays. Or C, their interest of the ghost of Shakespeare, who speaks to them through a local medium, but only in quotes from his plays. So, they are connected by what? A, the twee town of Stratford-upon-Avon. B, all the crimes are Shakespeare-based. Or C, the ghost of Shakespeare.
I'm going to say B.
B is incorrect.
Oh.
The answer was A. They all take place in Stratford.
I'm so glad it wasn't C.
I am disappointed it wasn't C, to be honest with you. Tara.
Yes.
Denmark. The Sommerdahl Murders. Mm-hmm. Sommerdahl.
Okay.
Follows a detective who's married to a forensic technician. But their working relationship is strained because A, he believes in ghosts, elves, and other such creatures, offering them up as explanations for the crimes they investigate. B, his passion for pastries gets in the way of solving mysteries.
Uh-huh.
C, she's cheating on him with his partner, another detective.
B.
B, pastry. He loves those pastries.
No.
It is the conventional, his partner. Back to Sarah. From Australia. Mr. and Mrs. Murder follows a married couple who solves murders in their line of work as what? A, dueling pastry chefs. B, Shakespearean actors. C, industrial cleaners.
C.
Is Love correct. That. Industrial cleaner.
What a good idea for a show.
To Omar. Mm-hmm. Also from Australia. The lighthearted series My Life is Murder. Sounds light. Follows the exploits of Alexa Crowe, played by Lucy Lawless. Crowe is best described as A, an ex-cop whose libido sometimes complicates her investigations. B, the mom of three who has to juggle a teenager, toddler, and solving mysteries. Or C, a widowed medium who has to juggle taking care of three kids and the ghosts of murder victims that want her to solve their cases. So, A, libido. B, juggling mom stuff.
Yep.
And C, widowed medium.
Is one of the murder victims Shakespeare? what country is it from?
Australia.
I'm going to say A.
A is in fact correct. Or as I like to abbreviate it to, incorrect. Tara.
Yes.
Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Which of the following is not true of Brenda Breathlin's title character on the long-running Vera?
Okay. Go on.
A, she dresses in what could be described as a Paddington Bear cosplay.
Okay. I know that one is true.
B, a brain tumor leads her to see the ghosts of dead people in the cases she investigates.
Okay.
C, she lives alone in a tumble-down shack on top of a hill in Northumberland.
God. I'm going to say ghosts is not true.
Ghosts is not true?
B.
Correct.
Okay.
Sarah, from Britain. A recent entry into the genre, McDonald and Dodds, features a hard-charging woman detective paired with an older male sergeant who's notable for what? A, wearing a kilt at all times. B, having a brogue so impenetrable that it requires subtitles. Or C, solving every case so far by going up to the library and looking up things.
Oh my gosh.
So, A, kilt. B, brogue. Subtitles. C, library.
And this is what is true.
He's notable for which one of those?
Got it. Brogue.
He's not. Notable for going to the library and figuring out them crimes.
Oh, good for him.
You can find out about this murder at your local library. Omar, New Zealand. The Broken Wood Mysteries, set in beautiful New Zealand countryside and now in its sixth season, stars Neil Ray as Mike Shepard, an overweight cop who drives a beat-up car and loves Patsy Cline. B, Terry Wolls, a cop with anger issues who's used to the mean streets of Wellington. Or C, Derek Shearer, a widowed cop who is bothered by ghosts of local murder victims after his wife dies. So, Broken Wood Mysteries stars this guy. Is he the guy who loves Patsy Cline? The guy who's used to the mean streets of Wellington? Or the widowed cop who's bothered by ghosts of local murder victims?
One of these has got to be the ghost one, so I'm going to say C.
C is incorrect.
No. He
drives a beat-up car, and he loves Patsy Cline. Mm. Tara.
Yep.
Britain.
Yep.
Rosemary and Thyme, mm-hmm. which ran from 2003 to 2007, okay. centers on A, retired cop and a high-end chef who solve food-based crimes.
Okay.
B, a retired cop and a vicar's ghost who solve Church of England-based crimes.
Okay.
Or C, a retired cop and plant pathologist who solve gardening-based crimes. So, Rosemary and Thyme, is it chef and food-based crimes?
Yes.
Vicar and church crimes? Or plant pathologist and garden crimes?
Chef.
Incorrect. Rosemary and Thyme, those are their names, of course.
Uh-huh.
Retired cop and plant pathologist.
Bullshit.
Oh.
Investigating crimes that happen in gardens? And it lasted four seasons?
Go to hell.
It lasted four seasons. It's England.
Four seasons of gardening. It was meant to be.
Do you know how many living people there are left in Midsummer? Zero.
Back to Sarah. Ooh, in the World War II set series Foyle's War.
Hey! Ooh.
It continued after the war was over with the main character doing what? A, trying gardening but constantly getting sucked into mysteries in the little town he retired to.
Sure.
B, working for counterintelligence as a commie hunter.
Ooh.
Or C, working from behind the scenes to help his hapless former assistants solve crimes. Foyle's War, canon, not inductee.
I thought I watched all of them, but they fell. I know it's not A.
Oh, I'm sorry. A, getting sucked into the little mysteries of the town. B, counterintelligence. C, helping hapless former assistants solve crimes.
I think it's C.
It is not. He is a counterintelligence commie hunter.
Boo.
Fuck.
Omar. Britain again. Sir, the Inspector Morse prequel series Endeavor, featuring a hot young Morse, spends a lot of time establishing which trait of his from the later series. A, why exactly he hates Mason so much. B, how he came to love cryptic crosswords. Or C, the origins of his enormous collection of classical records. So, what does the sequel series explain? A, Masons. B, crosswords. C, classical records.
I'm going to try A.
A is correct.
Hey.
Oh, he hates those Masons so much.
Hey.
All right.
Yes.
Here's one from Canada.
Okay.
The Frankie Drake mystery, set in the Toronto of the Roaring Twenties, has featured appearances from all but which of the following period-appropriate celebrities? A, Steve Lund, Jake from Schitt's Creek, as Ernest Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
B, Honeysuckle Weeks of Foyle's War as Agatha Christie.
Sure.
Or C, Kevin MacDonald from The Kids in the Hall as Nikola Tesla.
Oh, man.
So, A, Ernest Hemingway. B, yeah. Agatha Christie. C, Tesla.
Who did not? Boy.
So one of these.
Yep, I know. Okay. Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie is incorrect.
No!
Kevin MacDonald, Kids in the Hall.
That seemed just crazy enough to
it
be
did,
true.
But it did not happen, unfortunately.
Okay.
I can see it happening, though.
Yep.
That's the Dan Casino magic.
Boy.
To Sarah. We're halfway through our game.
Okay.
Grantchester, which might be described as What If Father Brown But Hot, has had two different sime-crawling vicars during its run. Which of the following does not describe one of them? One of the vicars is an Oxbridge-educated jazz lover. One of the vicars is a former Catholic priest who loves bell ringing. One of the vicars is a motorcycle-riding bad boy who loves boxing. So, which one of these does not describe one of them? A, Oxford-educated jazz lover. B, former Catholic priest who loves bell ringing. Or C, motorcycle-riding bad boy.
I think it is not bad boy.
It is bad boy. It is not the former Catholic priest who loves bell ringing, which we watched in the Father Brown episode that was in.
Oh.
So that is from Father, yeah, from Father Brown.
It was an extremely memorable episode, obviously.
Omar, also from Britain. In Queens of Mystery, a young cop is helped by her investigations by whom? A, her four meddling godmothers whose diverse backgrounds give them lots of insight and contacts. The ghosts of real past female leaders in Britain. Or C, a gossipy troupe of local drag performers. All right, so the Queen of Mysteries investigations helped by A, four meddling godmothers, B, ghosts of great past female leaders in Britain, C, gossipy troupe of local drag performers.
I'm not falling into the ghost trap again, Dan. C.
C is incorrect. It is four meddling godmothers.
I would watch the hell out of C, though. Someone needs to make that show pronto.
That sounds fun.
Tara.
Yep.
Britain again. In A Touch of Frost, which ran for 18 years on ITV.
Good Lord.
The brilliant lead detective has which of the following unsettling habits? A, he breaks into the houses of other police officers in order to clean them up. B, he drinks other people's tea and coffee if it is laying about. C, his house is filled with stuffed foxes and other animals he's hunted during the weekends in the country. So, his unsettling habit is A, does a Monica in other people's houses.
Yep.
B, drinks people's tea and coffee if left unattended.
Yeah.
C, his house is filled with stuff boxes and other trophies.
B.
B is correct.
Nice.
Wow, we are all tied up after more than half of these questions with two each. Dan.
Yay, us.
All right, back to Sarah.
Cozy.
Britain again. Midsummer Murders, now in its 21st series, is notable for all but which of the following? Notable for all but which of the following? A, the original author has refused to allow a vicar ever to be the killer, but every Catholic priest on the show has been a criminal of one sort or the other. B, the middle-aged lead and his spouse are always very excited to spend time together. Or C, the lead was replaced with his not quite identical cousin who moved into his house, took over his job without anyone much noticing or caring. So, A, Catholics are always...
Anti-Catholic
sentiment.
Huguenots.
B, always excited to spend time with his spouse. Or C, not quite identical cousin, which did not apply.
B.
It's notable for all but... B, no. It is, in fact, the anti-Catholic one.
Huh.
Which is too bad.
Strange. Expect more anti-papacy from the British.
They're working on it. All right. To Omar. The BBC 2 show Vexed, which the Telegraph called truly abysmal, featured a detective who was constantly distracted from the case by A, his status as the 14th Count of Wembley, B, trying to sleep with the suspects and or victims, or C, his impenetrable Scottish accent. So, it's a truly abysmal show. Featured detective constantly distracted from the case by being the Count of Wembley, trying to sleep with suspects or victims, his Scottish accent.
Say B.
Correct.
Nice. He's
always trying to sleep around with them suspects and victims.
Classic. And ghosts.
And ghosts of Shakespeare. Tara, back to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Fisher's Murder Mysteries is a long-running series set in 1920s Australia. So the spin-off Mrs. Fisher's Modern Murder Mysteries concerns what? The original Mrs. Fisher's niece, a mod detective in the 60s. The original Mrs. Fisher's granddaughter, a Miami Vice-style detective in the 80s. Or the original Mrs. Fisher's great-grandniece, a computer hacker slash detective in the 2010s. So, is it A, mod detective in the 60s, B, Miami-style detective in the 80s, or C, computer hacker slash detective in the 2010s?
A.
A is correct.
Nice.
That sounds fun.
It does.
Sarah, from Britain, on the Mallorca Files... which is legally not Death in Paradise. A British detective is working in Mallorca for all but which of the following reasons? So which of these is not one of the reasons? A, she was too uptight for the UK police, so they transferred her. B, Mallorca has a separate justice system for tourists and expats, apparently. C, the Spanish police...
Whoa, the fix is in!
Sorry. The Spanish police are too corrupt, so they've contracted serious investigations out. So, the British detective is working in Mallorca for all but which of the following reasons? A, she was too uptight for the UK police. There's a separate justice system for tourists and expats. The Spanish police are too corrupt.
I think it is not B.
It is B, and it is A. The answer was C. The Spanish police are just too corrupt.
That's the last one I would have picked.
You wave some euros under their nose and like, what murder? Omar. Britain. The long-running Inspector Morse was the cozy mystery series for puzzle solvers and incorporated which of the following puzzles into their episodes? The name of the killer was incorporated into the note structure of opening music of each episode until the viewers clued in. The cryptic crossword Morse is shown working on at the start of every episode when solved contains the name of the killer. Or C, the opera or symphony Morse listens to during each episode includes a performer whose name, when anagrammed, indicates the killer.
Oh, God.
So which was the hidden clue?
Wow.
It was in the opening music of each episode. B, the crossword. C, the opera or symphony.
I think it's B, the crossword.
It is A. The opening music had note structure.
Those sound really annoying.
No kidding. Ugh. Sounds
quirky
unbearable.
Much.
Tara.
Yep.
Jonathan Creek stars QI's Alan Davies as an investigator with what profession? Designer of magic tricks for a conceited magician. An architect who renovates old houses. A London novelist who thought he was going to get some peace and quiet in the countryside. So, he's an investigator with what profession? A, magic trick maker. B, architect. C, novelist.
I think it's A.
It is A. He was nice. A designer of magic tricks.
I learned that from the Appointment Television podcast because they watched that and they did not like it, as
it
I recall.
Sounds terrible. Score break, please, Star.
All right. Very close game. Sarah has 2 points. Omar has 3 points. I have 4 points.
All right. Everybody's last question coming at you. So there are some do and dies here. For Sarah, from Britain. Pie in the Sky focuses on a retired cop who opens a restaurant, but is blackmailed into remaining on the force. His restaurant is famous for A, an addictive bubble and squeak. The secret ingredient is kimchi. B, an addictive toad in the hole. The secret ingredient is raisins. C, an addictive steak and kidney pie. The secret ingredient is anchovies. So, Pie in the Sky. His restaurant is famous for kimchi bubble and squeak, raisin toad in the hole, anchovy kidney pie.
I feel like we're being sub-raisin tweeted with that with that one. C.
Kidney pie with anchovies is correct.
Nice. / disgusting.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Omar, your last question is also from Britain. On Inspector Linley, a BBC series that ran for 7 years, the inspector is distinguished by being A, prize-winning horticulturalist, B, the 8th Earl of Asherton, or C, former winner of a Great British Baking Show style series. So, the inspector is distinguished by prize-winning horticulturalist, B, 8th Earl of Asherton, C, former winner of a baking show style series.
A.
A is incorrect.
Oh.
They were the 8th Earl of Asherton. Last question is for you.
Yes.
It is from Britain. Which of the following is not an actual episode of the very popular Agatha Raisin series? About a London businesswoman who retires to the country and solves crimes, which is not an actual episode. Yeah. A, Agatha Raisin and the Crooning Cowboy, about a murder mystery of a Patsy Cline cover artist during the local country and western festival.
Okay.
B, Agatha Raisin and the Quiche of Death, about a murder in the local quiche making contest. C, Agatha Raisin and Hell's Bells, about a murder among the local bell ringers. So which of the one is not an episode? Agatha Raisin and the Crooning Cowboy and the Quiche of Death and Hell's Bells.
I gotta say C.
C is incorrect.
Damn it.
That was an episode. The false episode was the Crooning Cowboy. Crooning Cowboy. All right, that is regulation. So let's hear the final scores, please.
The very close game right to the end. Sarah and Omar were tied with 3 points each, and I finished with 4.
All right, close game.
Tally-ho, governor.
I know we said there was a tiebreaker. I'm glad there was no tie because it doesn't appear to be a tiebreaker. So we'll just go on and congratulate Tara.
Tara!
Yay!
Tara.
Hooray.
You know who would have killed at that game? Allison Lohuff.
Oh, yeah. Also my mother.
Also everybody in Britain over 52.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We stumbled around aimlessly and put weird things in our mouths while trying to form our first independent thoughts about Apple's becoming you before going around the dial with stops at The Crown, Candyland, That Animal Rescue Show, and Law & Order SVU. Tara made the case for the low-key Joe Parra reads you the church announcements for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Dan. Next up is TV Grudges on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's Supernatural finally ending, apparently. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole. And on behalf of Tara Ariana.
We are not amused.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Cry, Rin. Do your best.
And Omar Gallega.
I am the ghost of Shakespeare.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra. Hot Great.
Music is great, Starbucks is great, and please check out Bob O'Reilly by The Who.